This is Nicole Cox from the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, accompanied by Deborah
Chloe
Hendricks. I am here today, December 4th, 2010, in Gainesville, Florida, with Mr. George Sternfels. Did I pronounce that right?
You got to get the middle name in.
Okay, we'll get that in a minute.
Snow?
Okay, George Snow Sternfels.
Correct.
Perfect. We are conducting this interview for the Veterans History Project in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Thank you so much for being willing to talk to us, Mr. Sternfels.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's start off with what's your full name, which you've already given us, but maybe you could spell your last name for us to make sure that we get it right. Can you spell your last name?
S-T-E-R-N, F as in Frank, E-L-S as in Sam.
Perfect. Where were you born and when?
The Big Apple.
The Big Apple.
New York City, right? Midtown Manhattan.
What year was that when you were born?
A couple of years before you were.
A couple?
I was born March 6th, 1916.
Okay. What did your family do? What were they doing in New York? Your mom and dad, or?
My mother passed away when I was 10 years old. I had an older sister who was 18 years older than me. Older brother who was 8 years older than me. I came along, I was the mistake. My mother, as I say, passed away when I was 10 years old. My father never remarried. My older sister, or my sister, literally gave up her whole life to bring up the two boys. We stayed together, we lived together, we ate, we did everything together. We were an extremely close family and lived in New York City. My father was in the advertising business, was hurt very badly during the Depression, but always made a good enough living for us to be able to live as well as possible at that time. We didn't have to give up our home, nothing like that. And always lived in Midtown Manhattan. I was born there. The whole family were born there. My wife was born there. She was an only child. Interestingly enough, her father died before she was born. Her mother came from Denmark, was a marvelous, marvelous cook, and she opened a restaurant. Very successfully. She made enough money to be able to send my wife through college, who went to Hunter College, which is a pretty damn good college in New York, and graduated as a math major, went on to become a statistician, probably made 5 times more than I did. She was a statistician and budget controller for R.H. Macy's. And she was with them for about, almost from the time she got out of college until we expected our first child. By that time, I was doing better monetarily. And it was her idea that she resigned because she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. And so it all worked out wonderfully well. She did one hell of a job bringing up my wonderful daughter and son. once they were grown, I traveled a lot prior to that because of my position. Once the children were grown, we traveled a great deal together. My wife and I have been in every state in the United States.
Wow.
I think we counted, we'd been in 17 countries in Europe. And we had a remarkably good life together. Unfortunately, I lost her on the day of our 55th wedding anniversary. I've been in Gainesville for 30 years, lived in a house that was in Gainesville. It was a pretty good sized house. And my wife started to have the beginning of Alzheimer's. I need not tell you it's a very difficult thing to deal with. But she didn't want to be put in a nursing home. And so we stayed together and I took care of her till she finally passed away. But shortly, well, maybe 6 or 8 months before that, I knew the house was too much for me. And so we started to look around for places of this type. This place was for sale, although things get sold in here like that because it's a very, very advantageous neighborhood. You pay a lot for maintenance, but the place is extremely well kept. And we bought this, maybe about a year, year and a half before she passed away. Really was a very good thing because it was easy to maintain. You know, I had a lady come in and clean twice a month, and I did all the cooking, which I enjoyed. And we live very nicely here. There's plenty of room here, more than enough for me. There's a big bedroom down that way and a small bedroom down that way, a nice patio out that way, a wonderful, wonderful swimming pool, and I've always been a good swimmer and swam for my school, and tennis courts, which I no longer leave. And as I think I told you, really, really beautiful clubhouse that we have use of it if we reserve it. And I don't know whether you know it or whether I'm boring you with a lot of stuff that you really don't need.
Not at all.
I've been in the wine business all of my life. But prior to going into the Army, I worked for a company and sold both hard liquor and wine. I made a good living. I was with one of a very, very good company who were very liberal and very kind to me. But when I came back out of the Army, I had to do a lot of entertaining and drinking, and it just wasn't my way of living. And so I decided to get out of the liquor end completely. Wine was almost unknown at that time in the United States. The little wine that was consumed, do you know anything about wine at all?
Nothing much.
Was sweet wines are much higher alcoholic content than what we call dry table wines, which you generally consume with food. And so everybody wanted sweet wines, high alcoholic, cheap. They could get gaga fast. But, and so I decided that somehow or other, I don't know where it came from, but I just felt that wine eventually was going to make its way in the United States. Because of the length of time I sort of spent in Europe, and Europeans, of course, you know, are big wine drinkers. but they know how to drink wine properly. They don't drink wine to get out of their mind, for the better part of them. They drink wine to enjoy with their meal, and it's just pretty much an everyday occurrence with them. Wine was nothing in the United States at that time. So I went to I knew quite a bit about wine. I had studied it, but California had not come into its own at all. Practically all wine in the United States at that time came from upper New York State, the Finger Lakes. Little by little, California started to get into the wine business. Probably the finest wine school in the world is in California. I graduated from the California Wine Institute in California. That was not the school. The school was University of California, Davis. I took some courses there, but I never graduated from there.
When was that that you were taking the classes?
Pardon?
When were you taking the classes?
I took some classes there. As I said, I never graduated, but I did graduate from the California Wine Institute school.
What year?
I have no idea.
Before the war or after? This is
after. After the war. Now getting to the meat of probably what you want.
I had one question.
Go ahead.
I didn't ask you. What was your wife's name? Do you mind telling me?
My wife, as I said, my mother-in-law was born in Denmark, came over here as a young girl, got married, and her husband died before my wife was born. But my wife's maiden name was Dennison. And she was born in the United States, born in Manhattan. Surprisingly enough, we probably lived within about five blocks of each other. Went to the same grade school, junior high school, never knew each other.
Wow.
Well, you know, it's a big city. She was 2 years younger than me.
Okay.
I don't need somebody 2 years younger than me. But eventually, a long time later, surprisingly enough, we met on a blind date. There were three couples. We were all friends. The first date I ever had with her, all three friends and their girlfriends, none of them were married. We went to a very big amusement park, which was called Palisades Amusement Park, right across the Hudson River on the other side. We had a wonderful picture taken, a professional picture taken of the three couples in this open touring car. You know what a touring car is?
I think so.
Okay. I still have a copy of the picture.
Wow.
None of the couples were married at that time. We were all single. All three of those couples married the girls that they were with that night and stayed married to the same girls until they all passed away. I'm the last of the Mohegans. And I thought it was pretty neat, you know, that such a thing in our age, where, of course, divorces weren't as prevalent in my day as they are now. Today, you know, you're together for a year and then bye-bye, on to the next one. So it certainly wasn't that way in my day. And divorces were not very common. And I don't want to bore you with anything else. That's not what you're here for.
No, I want to hear all of it.
But that about brings you up to snuff.
Yeah, what year were you married? I'm asking you tough questions, huh?
No. I'll let you figure it out. I was 32 when I got married. My wife was 30.
I'll do the math. I'll do the math then.
Okay.
Okay. Well...
Now, getting to what you probably want to know, unless you have some other questions.
We can go ahead.
I went in the Army. I was drafted in when I was 26 years old. Before all the big hubbub really started. And I was certainly by far one of the older men in all the units that I was in because, you know, kids went in the Army when they were 18. Some of them lied and they were only 17. And so I was considerably older. But physically, if I say so myself, I was in extremely good shape. I never had any trouble keeping up with any of them, sometimes leaving them in the dust, which kind of annoyed them. And as I say, I was drafted in the Army at Fort Dix in New Jersey for 6 weeks, what they call basic training. And from there went to another Army camp called Camp Meade or Reed. The old brain isn't going around as fast as it used to. I think it was Camp Meade in Virginia. From there, not as a whole unit, but certain people were picked to, and I went, I left Camp Meade when my basic training was finished and went to Fort McClellan in, that's a show was called Fort McClellan. I don't know whether that was in between or not. But any place, the next place I went to was in Wisconsin. When I went to Wisconsin, maybe 3 months or 4 months after I arrived there, they started to form a unit which was called a ski patrol. I don't know if you ever heard of the 10th Mountain Division. 10th Mountain Division was all, nothing but a whole division of skiers.
Right.
Some of the best skiers in the, not only in the United States, but in the world. So they had a contingent that came from the 4th Mountain Division. I had skied before. Many of the guys were from the South. Some of them didn't even know what the hell snow was.
And that's your middle name, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And so I became part of the, it was actually the 70th Division, the 77th Division, Ski Patrol Unit. It was called Intelligence and Reconnaissance, but it was a ski patrol. We were shipped up to the Michigan North Woods. We built ice igloos out of blocks of ice that we cut. Suitable, not so suitable, for 12 men, which was a patrol that we lived in. A little pot-bellied stove in the middle of it. No cots or beds or anything. We slept in sleeping bags on the floor. And it was quite a rugged life. But I have never felt better in my life than when I was there. We went out on 3 mile runs every morning, ski runs, and then we come back and go through the rest of the exercises, all of this supervised by this contingent from the, what I told you before.
The 10th?
From the ski division.
The 10th division?
10th mountain division.
Okay.
And most of us became reasonably good skiers. As I say, I had skied before. Not that much, but I had skied. Most of the other men had never even, didn't even know what the hell a ski was. So it was a good unit. But you probably don't know it, but the 10th Mountain Division, although they had a big time history, was not very successful. And so the ski patrol in the division that I was in, the 77th Division, which was actually an infantry division, most of us were reassigned to another infantry division. I wound up with the 4th Infantry Division, who were in and went to Europe, not with them, but as what was known as a replacement. Then eventually joined the 4th Infantry Division, and that was the division that I landed with on D-Day. I have been told, it may be wrong, and I have never really verified it because I really don't care, that I am the oldest living veteran that landed on D-Day with the infantry. Now, there was Air Corps paratroopers that landed before us, but the infantry was the main landing group. And so I landed on D-Day with the 4th Infantry Division. Did not land at the beach, everybody says was the difficult one, which was Omaha. I landed on the beach called Utah, which was the other landing beach. As I say, I don't know anything about Omaha, but the difficulty of landing with Utah was that you came in to land on, I forget what they call, they're called, I think they were called landing barges. The whole front of the boat went down and you came off of it. And unfortunately, many of them could not get close enough to the actual beach. So many of them, the men landed in the water. I happen to have been, if I say so, an excellent swimmer. I swam for my school. You had 65 pounds on your back when you landed. I saw many, many poor guys drown because of this. I know I pulled myself, 3 men out of the water. You didn't get much recognition at that time for whatever you did, and I really wasn't interested in, you know, getting medals all over my chest. Didn't make a damn bit of difference to me. Stayed in combat for, I think, about a month and a half, and got very badly wounded. I became a, which I had had some training in the United States, a radio operator for our unit. Radio operator for your particular unit, you carried a big, I think it was called a 165 or 195, on your back. It was a big piece of equipment. And I thought, you know, in those early days of the war, did you ever hear of a hedgerow?
I think so.
In the early days of the war, we were fighting between hedgerows. What a hedgerow was a tremendously wide growth of like something like boxwood, if you know what boxwood, which is growth, very dense and very heavy, and that was what separated each farmland from the other. The Germans would be just on the other side of that, and you would be on the other side, and you had to try to find some way of breaking through it. The army had a few smart people in it, and so they came up with the idea of putting a bulldozer on the front of a tank. Tremendous piece of equipment. And that damn bulldozer could get through anything. You know, tanks are pretty powerful. I'm sure you know they don't have wheels, they have tracks. And so I was in the midst of trying to get a tank or two up so we could break through the hedgerow. I don't know how I had the common sense to think that if I stayed on that damn big set for very long, that the Germans were going to monitor in on it, which was quite common. So I had an assistant. I gave him my big set off my back. I took what was then known as a walkie-talkie, which I'm sure you know what it is. I was holding it to my ear, trying to get tank coverage up for us, and we were hit by mortar fire. As a result, it's one of the reasons I have no hearing in this ear, not a hell of a lot in this ear. This is a lot of grafting in here, but they did a wonderful job of rebuilding this part. I lost this finger, and this finger I have no use of at all because I was holding the walkie-talkie. I did stay in the hospital for a long, long time to be rehabilitated.
What was it like in the hospital?
Well, I was evacuated from France to England, and so that was where most of the evacuated on by boat to England, and I think was in move from one, which was quite common. They work on one part of you, then work on the other part of you. I think I wound up in probably 7 or 8 different hospitals, not being conscious all the time. I really didn't make any difference. And I really don't know how many hospitals I was actually in. Whatever it was, they did a very good job of eventually rehabilitating me. It took quite some time. And at that time, the great General Patton said to Supreme Headquarters, they were sending men back into combat when they came out of the hospital. And while he became not very well thought of, he was a very man. And so he sent word to Supreme Headquarters, if you can't send me fresh troops, keep them, I don't want them. Which was 100% right. Because, you know, you came out of a hospital, you were really not back in shape again, and they were sending all these men back up into the front lines. It came at a perfect time for me. And so they pretty much stopped, sending men that had been wounded back up to their unit in the front line. And I got reassigned to Supreme Headquarters, Sir Eisenhower. every week.
So you had been wounded twice, though, right? Once at D-Day and then...
No, not really.
Oh.
I was wounded only once.
Okay. I misunderstood.
And then evacuated back to England. This hand was pretty well shattered. Believe it or not, they did a lot of the fixing on the boat that evacuated us. And did a reasonably good job. And as I say, when I got finished with that, I was fortunately reassigned to SWEM headquarters. Pretty damn good job. I don't want to go into a lot of details of what happened to me and why I wound up with probably one of the finest jobs anybody in the entire Army could have. I was sent to, you know what billeting is? Billeting is housing for officers. And so I was sent to the billeting section. I was assigned with another soldier, and we literally ran in the suburbs of Paris, a beautiful, beautiful, way ahead of its time, apartment hotel, where officers came out of the field for, you know what R&R is? Came out of the field, filthy, dirty, scummy, scrubby, went into the hotel, some of them for 3, 4, 5, 6 days, a week, 2 weeks, no more, and lived in a suite. We had maids, took care of all the bedding, changed the beds, kept the place clean, and this was part of my job to have these maids do the things that were necessary to keep these officers happy. We had a, in the hotel, it was originally apartment hotel, it was not just a plain hotel, really, really beautiful, beautifully located in a small suburb of Paris, because SWEM headquarters was not actually in Paris at that time. It was in Versailles, which you probably know is close to Paris. And that was where all of the plotting and everything else for what was going to transpire in the front lines. That was where it was all planned. The suburb that I lived in was called, a very, very beautiful suburb, called Saint-Cloud, or in our language, St. Cloud. And that's where I was stationed. I was fortunate at that time to be able to get along quite well in French, with a big vocabulary, but no grammar. This was perfect for the people that worked for me. You know, they were not very bright people. There was nothing wrong with them. They were all good people. At first, I had an interpreter assigned to me. And eventually, the head of the housekeeping unit came to me and said, I was only a corporal, but they used to call me General Georges. And said, General Georges, she's a nice lady. She's English. She's married to a Frenchman. She talks French with an English accent. We don't really understand her. She talks over our heads. We've talked to you many times. We know that your vocabulary is tremendous. why don't you give us our orders? And to be very honest with you, I felt very badly because she was a very nice lady. But I called my commanding officer, told him, and so she was gotten rid of. And I handle with my partner, who did not speak any French, but he was a good guy. And so we got to handle all the help in the whole place. It was a pretty big hotel, and there was a lot of help. Place was kept immaculate. I don't care what I asked those girls or men to do. Oui, monsieur. Oui, General Georges. And it got done. So that was very good. And I stayed there until Supreme Headquarters moved up to Germany in Frankfurt am Main. I stayed in France at the hotel with a contingent of GIs where we did what is known as derequisition American holdings back to the French government. You have to remember that all of the things that we had, the apartment houses, the hotel, all were occupied by the Germans before we got there. And we just took over from the Germans. Needless to say, there was a lot of stuff missing, all taken by the Germans. And since I could get along in France, in French, I was part of a team that derequisitioned some of this things, paintings, you name it, back to the French government. I was probably the last of the GIs to stay in France because, as I say, Supreme Headquarters moved up to Germany, to Frankfurt am Main. I was left behind with a contingent to do this, some of the derequisitioning. And then eventually, my commanding officer up in Germany said to me, Sternfels, sorry to use the language, get your ass up here. You've been there long enough. Get on the next damn train and I want you up in Frankfurt. It was the end of a beautiful romance. And so I went up to Germany and still stayed with Supreme Headquarters up there. Supreme Headquarters had taken over apartment houses in Germany. So I lived in an apartment house. It was about the time when the Germans were starting to produce successfully, what do you call the lenses that go in?
Contacts.
Contacts. They produced the first contacts. I had heard about it, and so I wanted to go to Stuttgart, which is where these doctors were producing these lenses. And so I got permission to go to Stuttgart. And they examined my eyes and started to fit me. They were not that well perfected then, but they were good. They did a good job. Within three more days, I was there for maybe 8 or 10 days, and they were about to get finished with me and get the lenses in. And I got a call from a very, very good friend of mine back in Frankfurt. I don't like to use language, but he said to me, George, get your ass back here. You're shipping out for the USA in 2 days. Boom. That was the end of the contact lenses, which I never got. Got back to Frankfurt, and 2 days later, I was on my way to the United States. What more can I tell you? What else do you want to know?
I have a couple questions.
Go right ahead.
One is, did you have any French language training in the United States before you went overseas? Did you know?
Oh, yeah. I took French in school.
Okay.
Basic French. But had a very delightful girlfriend. 100% French. Extremely wealthy family. Happened to be in the wine business. And I went with Marie-Thérèse for probably a year and a half. She spoke practically no English, little English from school, the same as my French. But eventually a family were incredibly good to me. I used to have dinner at their home on a very regular basis. They had a beautiful home with cooks and maids and butlers, etc. So I lived pretty high on the hog because of her, but we became very, very good friends and thought quite hard. I think she thought harder than I did about getting married. For some reason or other, I just had my heart that I wanted to marry an American girl. And we parted fairly good friends. We corresponded for a while after I got back to the United States. But I knew in my heart it was never going to happen. I knew in her heart she thought it positively would happen. And so the romance eventually came to an end. And when I first came back from the States, I would call up a girl for a date. Girls that I had known from a long time and had dated. Oh, George, it's so good to hear from you. I hear you were in the army and you got wounded and blah, blah, blah. I hope you're okay. Yeah, sure. How about having dinner with me tomorrow night? Oh, George, I'm married. I've got two children. Sam and Nora. And this went on for maybe, five or six different, they were all married. Finally, I took out my little black book and I said, that girl's a career girl. She's not married, I don't think. Called her up, Norma, who became my wife. And I said, hi, Norma, this is your old friend, George. Oh, how are you? I hear you in the ba 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 ba. I said, how about having dinner with me Saturday or Friday or what? Oh, that would be great. I'd love to see you. That was the beginning of a beautiful romance.
Okay.
And, of course, eventually we got married. And nobody has ever had a greater marriage than I did. Traveled all over the world together. An incredibly good, brilliant, brilliant woman. Thank God my children took after her. and we had a fantastic marriage. And as I tell people now, I don't have any regrets. I have nothing to complain about. I've lived a wonderful, wonderful life. I've worked hard at what I did. Worked very hard at it. I was away from home much more than I should have been, but it was part of my job. I became national sales manager for one of the biggest importers of wine in the United States. You probably don't know, nothing about liquor either?
Not enough.
You know anything about names of liquors?
Some.
They were the first ones to bring vodka into the United States, Smirnoff vodka.
Right.
Now there are probably 30 vodkas in the United States. It is still the largest selling vodka in the United States. It's produced in the United States. It's not produced in Europe. They got the right and the formula to produce Smirnoff Vodka and the use of the name in the United States. This was the company I worked for. I don't want to go into details. They were very, very kind to me when I worked for them. I eventually left them, went in business for myself, did some of my own importing, and went into the retail business in first in Midtown Manhattan, in New York State, unlike many other states, including Florida. You are only allowed to have one license. You can't have multiple licenses like ABC or whoever else that have 10, 15, 20 stores. You only will have one license. I eventually sold the one that I had opened in Midtown Manhattan. We had left New York City because it was about time for my children to start school. And although my wife and I, school system had changed in New York, as it had in many large cities. And so we just felt that they would have gone to the same school that both my wife and I graduated from, because that's where we lived. And we eventually decided that we would prefer to send them to live in a different area where schooling was far superior. And so we moved to a suburb of New York. Beautiful, beautiful suburb, convenient to commuting to New York, called Hastings on the Hudson. Wonderful community, and that's where my children grew up. They went from grammar school through high school at that one school in Hastings on the Hudson, and then both graduated. My daughter went to a state teachers' college. My son, who was 2 years younger, went to Boston University. It was at the time when there was a lot of hubbub and strikes and walking out by students at universities. You probably don't know about it. This probably lady probably does. And finally, my son said, "I just can't take this anymore. You know, every day we get called out of class. There's a bomb scare. There's this. There's that. There's a strike. That blah, blah, blah. I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, I'm quitting Boston College." "Yeah, what are you going to do?" While he was at Boston College, he worked for RCA to make money for himself. He said, "I've saved quite a bit of money." And he said, "I'd just like to take some time off and travel around the United States." I said, "That's going to be a little expensive." "Oh no, I'm going to hitchhike," which was very prevalent in those days. It was not a big concern. He got and met some of the greatest people you would. He got rides from teachers, from ministers, from preachers, and, you know, would keep us posted on where he was going and what he was doing. To make the long story short, he wound up, eventually stopped traveling. I think he traveled for about a year and a half all over the United States. And he worked for the government for a while. The government would have him go out and distribute kitchen utensils and things like that to people in the perimeter of cities that couldn't really afford it. So he did that for a while, and eventually settled in, of all places, West Virginia. And he lived there for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And I don't know what prompted him. I think he found out that there was a good job available to him in Vermont. And so he moved to Vermont and worked in a very, very big, beautiful, pardon me, very, very beautiful apple orchard. A wonderful young couple owned the orchard. It was a big, big orchard. And they primarily grew apples, but they also had blueberries and blackberries. He became foreman of the orchard. So all he did after he got through being what's known as a picker. And all he did after that was ride around in a Jeep and make sure all the people were doing what they were supposed to be. His wife, as I said, was Dutch. She had come over from Holland. I know not how she wound up as an apple picker in that orchard. This is where they met. This is where they fell in love. Tra-la-la. And they were extremely happily married, built a lovely home for themselves in Vermont. She, if I say so, a bright lady. There was a very, very big, very expensive private boarding school where the apple orchard is. People come from all over the United States to send their children there. And she left the apple orchard and started to work for the school. The school is so big. They own thousands of acres. The name of the school is the Putney School. And the name of the town is Putney. So they're very influential, as far as that's concerned. And she eventually wound up with a very, very good job and is still with them. My son, as I say, never finished college. But they got married and he continued to work. And in all deference to my son, I think it was his wife that eventually said, "Paul, as far as I'm concerned, you are a smart man. You need to go back to college." He went back to college in New England, graduated summa cum laude, and started teaching. So all of the children are in the teaching profession, and that's the sum and substance.
That's really neat.
What else?
I wondered, you said when you were at Supreme Headquarters, you saw Eisenhower.
Well, on about a weekly basis at least, sometimes more, sometimes less.
Do you have...
Very, very fine gentleman. In spite of what anybody might say of him, truly a fine gentleman, and treated everybody that was anywhere near him extremely well, very cordial, "Hi, Sergeant, how, Corporal, how this, how you doing?" Very, very good man. Unfortunately, not a good person. But a good man. That's it.
When you were sent back to the United States, was the war still going on at that time? It was...
The war in Japan was going on.
Okay.
The war in Europe was over.
Okay.
And I don't want to bore you with all... I don't want it to go in the record. I had a is your thing on?
Yeah. We can just pause.
I would not like this to become part of that.
Okay.
It's a bit stuck.
Okay.
I've taught wine classes for Santa Fe College. This is my 25th year. I teach, usually according to their calendar, 4 or 5 semesters each year. I will not accept more than 30 pupils. If you don't register for my class on the first day of registration, by 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you don't get in, you go on the waiting list. I'm very proud to say I literally have hundreds and hundreds of wonderful students. These two are both former students. They go way back with me. I knew them before they were married, and I think they've been married for 21 years. Great people. They, big bucks. They're young. They practically do nothing but travel all over the United States and Europe. It's nice if you can do it. But they are also so very, very kind to me. If they're here in Gainesville, they'll be here every day. They're not here that much, but if they're here, they'll be here. Two great people. You see, I'm so fortunate because of the classes that I teach, 98% of the people that I know are young people. It has given me so much pleasure to constantly be associated with young people rather than, excuse me, old doddering. You know, it's just kept me young. I think it's what's made me live to 94. And there are so many of them that have been incredibly good to me. I think about maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I got this brainstorm and said, you know, some of these people repeat this class 10, 12, 15 times. One of the reasons is because I love what I do. I work very hard on picking out the wines to serve them each night. A semester is 6 weeks. And I work very hard at doing it. And I try to make sure, believe it or not, I have 5 major wholesalers that I deal with. Carry a tremendous amount of wine. I have one wholesaler in South Florida that ships to me because they all know how much good I can do them. Mm-hmm. And so I rarely serve in all these years the exact same wine. And they learn a lot about wine. I keep it on a light basis. I tell them little quippy stories about things and keep them laughing and so forth and so on. And enjoying some very, very fine wines. I think you may know that Adult Education, they pay to register Santa Fe College. They pay me $55 to buy the wine. And so, you know, each one of them, and if it's a couple, they're spending quite a bit of money. I got the idea, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years ago, that if they were in the class 10 times or more, they got a diploma for what is known as enology. Enology is a lover of wine. My daughter makes up actually official diplomas, a replica of a real diploma. And I sign the thing. And I give them the diploma wrapped around a very good bottle of wine. And I make the presentation. This Tuesday, I'll be making the biggest presentation I've made. I've got 7 people graduating. That means all 7 of them have been in the class 10 times or more.
Wow.
So I want desperately to be there Tuesday. My daughter will be here, and she and Walter will make sure somehow or other that they get me down there.
Good.
And should be a whoop-de-doo night.
Sounds like
it. And the last night is always bubbles, champagne, and sparkling wine. It's always the last night. So it should be a nice evening.
So,
the couple that was here when you came, mm-hmm. they're usually always in the class. They both got diplomas, but they keep coming back. They missed this class because they were in Spain and have come back from vacation. And I invited them down, plus a few others, even though they're not in the class, to just sit in back of the room. She'll take the call.
Oh, okay.
And just sit in back of the room and be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good. Should be a good night.
It sounds like it. Well, how did you come to Gainesville then?
When the children were young, we came to Florida every year at Easter time. They're like the old man, they're water rats. So they love the water and they love to water ski, etc., etc. So we used to go to either one coast or the other. I need not tell you, how long you've been in Florida?
A long time.
Well, I need not tell you that it's a hubbub over on either coast. And so when I first retired from New York, we bought a very nice home in the mountains of North Carolina. And lived there for 5 years. The cold and the little bit of snow that they got really never bothered us. You know, we're native New Yorkers. But one day, we were going into town, and we lived out a ways. The road was a blacktop. I thought it had rained. Solid ice. It literally slid down the whole side of the damn mountain with my poor darling wife like this. We got down to the bottom of the mountain, and my wife turned to me and said, "Sweetheart, enough is enough. We are out of here." And when my wife said, "We are out of here," we are out of here. And so we started to look around. We knew we didn't want to go to the coast. We rented in Sarasota. But we would go out every day and explore places where we might want to be. Orlando, Ocala, you name it, we went there. Never really found anything that we liked. One day, it's midday, we were going to head back for Sarasota. And I said to Norma, it's a short run from here. Let's take a run up to Gainesville. She said, "Where?" She said, "Where'd you find that?" I said, "Well, kind of a big blob on the map. I know there's a good university there. Let's just take a ride up there. It's not far from here. We'll go right up the main drag, which was 441, and we'll be on the main street, according to my map, of the town of Gainesville." "Sure, let's go." We came up to Gainesville. It was right at the right time of the year. Everything was in bloom on 441, the dogwood, the this, the that. And my wife said, "I give you credit. You know how to pick them. This is beautiful." She said, "Okay, now we're in Gainesville. Now what do we do?" I said, "We go to the first broker that we can find. There should be one that's the main drag. And we go in there, tell them what we want, and let them knock them chains out and show us around the town. And that's what we did. Believe it or not, we didn't buy for 3 years later. We would come back here on weekends, stay weekends, look at houses all over the damn place. I think the broker finally got desperate and he said, there's a new development in a very good area, the area that I've always told you in Gainesville that I think you should move to, which was the Northwest. And so he said, it has just started. I think there's only one house finished. He's a very, very reliable builder. Can I take you out there? Sure. So we went out there and we looked. We met the builder. There had only been one house built and lived in at the time. He was working on the next house, which was right across the street. And the more he told us and the more plans he showed us and the more we saw of the area, the more we liked it. It was the second development on the whole of 39th Avenue. I don't know whether you know it or not, it's called Emerald Woods. And that's where we bought the house 30 years ago. And that's where we stayed until my wife started to get real bad with the Alzheimer's. And I knew I couldn't handle the house. It was 3 bedrooms, 3 baths, 3 big dining room, living room, you name it. The builder had said, Mr. Sternfels, if there's anything that you want me to put in here, you let me know. You let me, give me an idea of what you want, and I'll build it to your specifications. So I said, well, I know in Florida I'm a nut, but I would like a really nice fireplace, stone, natural. No problem. You got it. It'll cost you so much. So be it. And I said I would also like a nice, big screen patio in the back. Give me an idea of what you want. I'll tell you how much it's going to cost you approximately, and you've got it. That's the story of Gainesville. And so we stayed here until, as I say, I decided it was too much, you know, with my wife and the condition. And so we came here and bought this. And it was a very, very good move for us. It's a great, great neighborhood. Wonderful, wonderful neighbors. We all know each other right in this little ballywick. And this is where my wife passed away. And then about 4 years ago, things set in here still like that. Rentals like that. I mean, it's convenient to everything. And so, I robbed a bank, and I knew of a place where the lady had passed away, and it was going to be up for sale. Again, to make the long story short, took it back and forth with a lawyer. They finally met my offer, and I bought the place across the way, which has been rented from the day I bought it, first to a very, very nice couple, who were both cardiac nurses at Chan's. They were there for 2 years and came to me and said, you know how much we love it here, but he had decided to go back to school and study to be an anesthesiologist, for which I couldn't hate him. And so they left, and my good friend Walter, who's a native of Gainesville, has been in the real estate business, is retired now, but he's been in the real, he was a big builder at one time. and he handles all of it for me. The rentals he handles for me. He's very careful who he lets in there. On this one, when it became vacant, there were four people that wanted it. He said, George, there's four people that want it. I'm not that happy with the references from three of them. The fourth one, her references are from banks. She owns a very, very big piece of property in the outskirts of Gainesville. If it's okay with you, this is who I'd like to have. She took the place immediately, a most delightful lady. I don't know why, and it's none of my damn business. She lives there all alone. It's exactly the same as this one story. He redid the entire place after the other place, people moved out. It was in beautiful condition. But she lives there all alone. She does not drive or have a car. Goes up the corner, takes the bus. Her daughter lives in Gainesville, picks her up once a week, takes her shopping. She wants to go to the mall, on the bus. She wants to go downtown, on the bus. Very, very nice lady. I get my rent 4 or 5 days before it's due. What more can I say? So he knows how to pick them.
Good.
What else you want to know?
When you were drafted, what rank were you going in?
What rank was I?
Yeah.
I was a lousy corporal.
And when you left?
I was a lousy... When I first went in, I was what was known as a buck private.
Okay.
Then became a private first class, and eventually a corporal. I was supposed to become a sergeant probably in about another 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Never happened. I left before then. Okay. So I stayed a corporal until I was discharged.
Okay. Well, I think that's all the questions that I have. You've been really patient, so thank you for answering
them. I've talked too damn much.
No, you haven't.
You've spent too much time with me.
Not at all.
But it was a nice visit.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.